This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota early in a beautiful June. Today, we're going to start our show talking about one of the attractions of the state so noted by the governor on the middle of March at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum when Jamestown Arts won the governor's award for arts organization. We're joined by the executive director of Jamestown Arts, Mindy Schmitz. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this was quite an honor that you won over many other people across the state, many other organizations. And I'm just going to share with our listeners some audio that was captured by our director of radio, Bill Thomas, when David White Thunder Trottier, chair of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, basically set up Governor Burgum to present the award. Here's what it sounded like.
Our final award of the evening in the category of arts organization is presented to an organization just down the road a ways, next to a river with a big buffalo in it. They're a shining star in North Dakota's cultural landscape. They were founded in 1964. They've grown from a group of area painters to a significant regional arts center with a gallery, stage, classroom, studios, and an artist residency apartment. It is the focal point for all things artistic in this town. As the art and cultural hub for the community, this place provides the venue, logistical and financial support that brings fine art exhibitions, cultural festivals, readings and humanities presentations, community theater, art classes and workshops, resident artists and various performing artists to the area. By finding creative ways to engage their community, their programs reach every age group, sector, and social group in their community, engaging them in experiences they most likely would never consider nor pursue, thereby creating a belief that the arts are for all. This is how you build community. They give voice to creative expression. They are a strong catalyst for collaboration across diverse organizations and sectors of their community. A hallmark is their ability to develop unique community partnerships to achieve their mission, to enrich the community through the arts, and work across sectors in cooperative relationships to advance their vision to create a community that embraces the arts as vital to life. In 2008, the organization purchased a vacant lot in the downtown area with a vision of creating a place in the center of downtown that could act as a hub of creativity. They have been a leader in providing arts, educational, and cultural programs in their region. Noteworthy milestones have included cultural programs like Midwest World Fest, Caravansary, and several cultural festivals that have brought artists from around the globe to their town. During these events, the public experiences was immersive with interactive activities to create common ground and break down cultural barriers. In 2019, they hosted the Downtown Arts Market in their arts park. And while they may own and operate the art park, it is seen as a place for the entire community to enjoy, gather, and utilize. In 2018, they received $100,000 from the Bush Foundation Community Cohort Grant Program to be utilized for operating support over 3 years, particularly related to community engagement.
Thank you, David. 2019 Governor's Awards in the category of Arts Organization goes to Jamestown Fine Arts Association. Mindy Schmidt, Art Center's new executive director, will be accepting the award. Let's give it up for the Jamestown Fine Arts Association.
Well, a nice round of applause for your organization, Mindy. And you were brand new to the organization, at least in its leadership role as executive director, when that came to you. So what does the recognition of Jamestown Arts by the governor and the State Arts Association mean to your association?
We were humbled by the award. There's no doubt about it. What it really means is all of the hard work of all the previous and current staff members here and members and donors. And I mean, this place is run by volunteers. And so it's just so much hard work from them and dedication. And we're just so proud of it. And it was a great opportunity.
How did Jamestown Arts get its start?
I think it was a group of local artists in 1964 that decided that they wanted to display their art someplace. And so they got together and they created bylaws for the subsequent Jamestown Fine Arts Association.
Well, that's 50-some years ago now, so it's been doing okay, I guess, for the time for that amount of time. But it's in a prominent location in downtown. Has it always been there?
Yes, it's always been in the former Our Lady building. Well, that's where the Arts Park is. We're in the Star building, actually. And then right across the alley, we bought another building of where we have a classroom and a studio. And then we also bought the Arts Park in 2008.
Well, we'll talk about the Hanson Arts Park, but let's get your background here. You're pretty new, as I mentioned. Tell us about your background.
Well, I'm a longtime resident of Jamestown. I've lived here for over 25 years, and I've spent most of my career working in farm policy and later environmental policy. And I was just looking for something different. The world doesn't see things the way that I do anymore, and this was just a great opportunity to give back to the community and to focus on kids and art and, you know, wonderful things in the world.
How many people does your association serve in a year?
Anything from the Arts After School program to our artists in residence to performers, I would say that we touch well over 1,000 folks a year between students and audience members and performers.
And how are you sustained, funded?
We're funded through membership and business sponsorships and grants and donations.
And how are you governed?
We're governed by our board of directors, 11-member board of directors who are local community members. Our current president is the former superintendent of the board, and there's a stay-at-home mom. I mean, it's just a variety of folks in the community.
Now, David Trottier mentioned the artist department for an artist in residence. Is there somebody in it now?
There actually is somebody in it now. Linda Roche was our artist in residence for the last school year, and we're not quite sure who's going to be the next artist in residence, but that person actually lives in our apartment. That's part of their stipend. And then through a generous grant from the Jamestown Public Schools and St. John's Academy, we're able to offer that service for the artist to actually go into the classrooms and teach art.
And how is that person selected?
There's a roster of folks that the North Dakota Council on the Arts suggests, and then we screen them and decide if they're a good fit for our community and get them to come here.
Now, Jamestown Arts has been recognized in previous years, and maybe you could give us a bit of history there. You won honors in 2017 and 2018 as well.
Yeah, well, the 2017 was an award for tourism, and that was highlighted because of our arts park. We work pretty closely with Jamestown Tourism here in promoting the things that we do here in our gallery and also at the park. And it's been a big draw. It's a big tourist attraction, actually.
Well, are these awards, do you think, a signal to other communities to look at what Jamestown's done and maybe, you know, get creative?
I would hope so. I actually had a conversation with somebody from Ellendale that's thinking about doing some sort of art center down there, and I think it was Ellendale. I guess I shouldn't say for sure. Maybe I let the cat out of the bag, but it's been a great asset to this community, and it serves all kinds of folks, from any kind of socioeconomic to cultural diversity. It's great.
Well, I was recently in Jamestown, and I pointed it out to my companion as I passed through that the Arts Park is quite visible. It's got a prominent corner right in the middle of downtown, and the Arts Association is across the street, as you mentioned. That's pretty valuable property, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Well, the reason I ask is because, of course, with everybody sort of building and expanding and improving and all that, is it in any jeopardy?
Well, I know it's not in any jeopardy, and the Arts Park actually was the site of a tragic fire, and it sat vacant for a while, and we just thought, well, it was pre my time, but the vision of the Arts Center folks here then thought, you know, we need to clean that up and fix it up, and let's make it a park, and then subsequently let's do some programming there.
Well, what programming do you have there this summer?
Every Thursday this summer, except for the 4th of July, we have what's called the Downtown Arts Market. And it starts at 5:30 and it ends at 8:30. And it's performances, and we have local artist vendors, and we have some food, and we have art activities. And the best thing, it's absolutely free to anybody who wants to come.
So you get pretty crowded on the corner on those days?
Yeah, we've had quite a few folks there, up to 200, 300, I guess, last year. we've kind of designated each month something different. June is the Cultural Kaleidoscope. July is Celebrate Sweethearts, and August is Community Favorites. And so I could get into some detail of what we're having there, but I think there's a little bit for everybody in the Jamestown and surrounding area.
Well, I noted in July you've got Walter Peale's Sweethearts of the Rodeo painting suite. He's a pretty well-known artist in North Dakota, very brilliantly colored abstract art, lots of rodeo stuff, lots of horses and cowboys and that kind of thing.
He's actually going to do a live painting during the arts market, and his exhibit is going to be shown in our gallery at that same time. So we like to tie in our exhibit with the performers and the artists on Thursday nights, too. So we also encourage everybody to take a look at the gallery when they come downtown.
And there's music there as well, and I should mention that in the July Celebrate Sweethearts piece at the downtown park, Jesse Veeder will be performing.
Yeah, everyone loves Jesse Veeder. She's great.
And she won the governor's award for individual achievement in the arts. So,
she was a lot smarter than I was. She was in the Virgin Islands, and I was in Bismarck to accept the award.
How do you set a season for your association?
Well, for the summer season, we kind of went on the success of last year. They had some really good programming last year, and we got a lot of returning acts. And so we have Sally Jepson here. She was kind of in charge of getting the performers, and we just went with that.
What's your vision for the future?
Well, we love what we've got here. We want to absolutely maintain the what we have. And, I mean, who knows? There's always a vision to maybe grow and into what, we're not sure. But it's just such a great place for this community and for the state. I mean, it's a gem. And so we just want to make sure that we offer great programming and a place that people want to come and visit and a place for people want to come and actually, you know, experience art. And art can take on any kind of life form, as you know. And so we just want to make sure that it's the best that it can be.
And it's not just an experiential thing. As you mentioned, you have an educational component. Tell us a bit more about that.
So I talked about the Artists in Residence program, and the thing that we're probably the most proud of here at the Art Center is our Arts After School program. And that's from kids grades 3 through 6, and we provide transportation from school and to home after they're done with their class, and that's every day, virtually every day after school. And if kids can't afford it, we have scholarships. And so we have all kinds of kids that come, and it's a lot more than a latchkey program. It's a program where kids actually learn art skills, and it's been shown that art component in education is extremely important for the success of kids. And so we're very proud of that.
And you, of course, are not too far from the University of Jamestown, one of your alma mater. That relationship must be a benefit as well. There are artists there.
Yes, absolutely. They've got a great, strong art program there, and we've utilized those students and those instructors. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm working on a stronger relationship with them and their art department and their theater department as well.
When you mention theater department, that's near and dear to me. Are there performance opportunities at Jamestown Arts?
Yeah, there are. There's actually a summer camp that's going to happen in July that we're partnering with the Two Rivers Performing Arts Center, which is just across the street. But they're having the play here with the kids that are in our summer camp and others, too. So there's that. And then we will do some community theater this fall as well.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot going on at the Jamestown Arts, also known as the Jamestown Fine Arts Association. Mindy Schmitz is the executive director. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
It was great, Doug. Thanks for having me. Anytime.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The 29th Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival will be held Friday and Saturday, June 14th and 15th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. Bands are coming from Alabama, Ohio, Minnesota, and North Dakota, and hosted by Washburn's very own Cottonwood. 16 and under are free, there is great camping and late-night jamming, and you can learn a bluegrass song at the workshop on Saturday. More information online at cottonwoodbluegrass.com or by phone at 701-794-3731.
Is it true that I've lost you? Am I not?
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in our Fargo studio by Ashley Thornburg. And in Bismarck, we have Vanessa Voskuhl. She's a choreographer and the creator of a special show coming to the stage of the Heritage Center in Bismarck this weekend.
Vanessa, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's going to be a performance of En Masse North Dakota, and we had you on a few months ago to talk about the audition process. And basically, you were creating a show based around who showed up. You didn't know what your show was going to be like. So who showed up?
Well, there was people from all sorts of backgrounds in dance experience, or some don't have dance experience. I have about 18 performers. They are very diverse in age. My oldest is 74. I think the youngest is in her early 20s, just graduated from University of Minnesota Dance Department. And the performers who are in this piece are just amazing. They've dedicated 6 weeks to the rehearsal process every Saturday, and for a couple hours, and they've been working real hard to get this piece to the stage at the Heritage Center.
Well, I went up online to your website, VanessaVoskuhl.com. That's Voskuhl spelled VOSKUIL.com, and I looked at some of your work. It is very arresting, very interesting. So describe the performance that people will see this weekend at the Heritage Center.
Well, this piece originated with an open call to the community. I was waiting to see what I was really going to do with the work until I found out who was in the piece, so I could really tailor the work to the community that formed around this work. And I got a really, you know, diverse a group of people, and was just really excited about that. And so when we got to rehearsals, I had already put together the sound score, which is about an hour, and knew I was going to do some group work with them, but also was interested in featuring the performers in solo work. And so it took a little coaxing, but there's going to be several solos that span anything from 30 seconds to about 3 minutes. And we did a lot with experiences that brought us joy in our lives, and also experiences that were about growth and connection and community. And that was our basis for the themes around the work. And the performers, I asked them to create some movement around their experiences. And some of them would ask me to help them, and some of them just went ahead and made a whole little solo for themselves. And I just love that diversity in the movement that has come out of this rehearsal process. And the group work also emphasizes the solo work in the piece. And in addition to just creating movement together, is about community and growth and connection. And we fill up the whole stage, and the work is just really come together in this en masse experience.
Can you paint us a little bit of a mental picture here after a tease like that? When you say people created movement, how do you describe some of the movement that you see?
Well, some of the performers have Bharatanatyam, classical Indian, East Indian dance background. It's hard to describe movement, but it's they have a lot of specific hand gestures and facial gestures and movement with the feet. Sometimes there's include stomping. I would say there's some pedestrian gestures about growing or the outside or gardening that is depicting some of the stories around spending time with the family outside. And some of the movement stories are about having children, where the gestures are they start laying on the ground and then they grow from there, and experience joy. I mean, there's lots of joy in the facial expressions and in the movements.
It sounds like when you were rehearsing this, mm-hmm. there was an improvisational stage here, and you sort of cemented things. You're talking about stories. Are we hearing these stories literally while people are dancing? Are they reciting stories?
No, they're not speaking on stage. So they're telling the story of their experience through movement. It has kind of like this storytelling gestural effect, but it's also kind of abstracted a little bit. So it's not a very literal interpretation. So there's one story about harp making, and in the movement she shows how she's creating the harp. She's making the harp and song, and then how she's stringing the harp, and the movements are just, they're just beautiful and light, and then she shares the joy afterwards in a little joy dance. And you know, I don't know all the stories of all the performers, but I do know there's one that's about traveling and eating food and enjoying that experience. And there's lots of open arm movements and throwing of mangoes. And it's really the movement. I mean, it's a contemporary performance piece, so it's just a really broad movement vocabulary inside the work.
How many people came to the open call?
Well, it was a sign-up process. They didn't have to come to an audition or anything like that. But I believe there was about 30 people who were interested and who I talked to and were inquiring about the work. And 22, I think, signed up through the website or through email. And then 18 went through with the performance.
Your work has been very well received by critics in the Twin Cities. What brought you back to your hometown?
Well, I was traveling. I had a fellowship in Japan and put everything into storage in Minneapolis. And I wasn't sure of my next steps after that. And my parents live in Bismarck, and I grew up in Bismarck. I'm from here originally. And I decided to come back and spend time with my family while I can. And so I've been here for a little over a year and a half now. I spent the winter here and worked on this piece.
Well, I again remark about what I saw on your website. I saw a demonstration of a piece you did called The Student, which is really remarkable. Mm-hmm. And it uses music and in this environmental sound in very innovative ways. What will people hear?
Oh, the sound score, it's an open sound effect. There's some drones. I'm using music from a French artist, Elaine Radigou, and she's inspired a lot by Buddhist sounds and drones, and this kind of has like a choral and organ sound, and then there's like some really fun, playful music from Love Lies Crushing, and then some more kind of nature sounds in it towards the end, kind of sounds like cicadas. And it goes from very kind of small, singular, kind of very specific sound effects to very kind of epic kind of feeling in the piece to kind of convey this feeling of large community and people coming together. And there's some additional sound design by Jesse Whitney and myself. There's some drums that come in. It kind of winds in and out of itself over the hour that we'll be performing.
Why do you want to call it En Masse, North Dakota?
Well, I did a piece called En Masse, just En Masse, in Minneapolis in 2009, 10 years ago. And I thought this would be a follow-up to that piece, and that the structuring of the work was very similar, and that I had an open call to the community, and 80 people were in that piece. And we had a 10-week rehearsal process, and anybody could participate in it. And I wanted to have that similar feeling of anyone could participate in the work, and en masse, just come together, and we will do this together. And the piece has that quality to me of events that are kind of, you know, larger than ourselves in a group format.
Is En Masse something that you will continue to work on and present in different ways?
Yes, I would love to present this work in different ways and in different communities. It's something that I would like to do in North Dakota and maybe in different towns, but definitely in any other community that would want to bring me in to do this work would be a wonderful opportunity for me.
Vanessa Voskuhl is the choreographer and creator of En Masse North Dakota. It'll be on stage at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum Saturday and Sunday. The performances are 2 in the afternoon, and they're all free and open to the public. This is presented in partnership with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and Dakota West Arts Council. Vanessa, good fortune to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media and Marketing Ag Commodities. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A study shows power companies serving the Bakken will need to find another 1,000 megawatts to serve the continued growth in the area. The study was done by Bismarck-based Barr Engineering for the North Dakota Transmission Authority.
I'm quite excited about the results of the study.
John Wieda is the authority director.
Most utilities around the country would be excited to have this kind of growth in their territories, and I think here in North Dakota, the utilities are ready and anxious to meet that need. So I think it's a very interesting and good outcome.
Wieda says the study cites a number of factors leading to the load growth.
It's the production. It's the processing of the gas. It's the population impacts. It's the other industries that support the oil industry. So it's pretty much everything that takes place out in the Bakken, but driven, of course, by the fact that there is oil there.
Wieda says he's confident the utilities that serve the area will find ways to meet the need. Volunteers with the Dakotas Region of the Red Cross are gearing up for an active summer. Gretchen Jelmstead is Regional Communications Officer for the Red Cross. She says there are currently 7 volunteers deployed from this region. The volunteers are deployed to Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma to assist in recovery from floods and tornadoes. Jelmstead says the volunteers do everything from working in shelters to distributing supplies. She says volunteers go through training specific in their areas of interest, but you don't necessarily have to be a Red Cross volunteer in order to be prepared for a disaster. Jelmstead says you have to be ready for everything.
Last year we had a large tornado out in Watford City, and that you just never know, especially with summer storms. They can be so unpredictable and can happen in a split second. And so just making sure that people are prepared, that they have a plan. If you have a family, talk to your kids about what is a thunderstorm watch versus a warning. If there's a tornado watch or warning issued, what do I do? You know, make sure that you're listening to local radio and news about that. Make sure that you know to go in the lowest level of your home or away from the windows. So it's really just about education and being prepared.
There are currently about 500 volunteers with the Dakotas Region of the Red Cross. Jelmstead says some deploy across the nation to help with disasters, but many stay local to help with things like CPR training, smoke alarm installation, and community events. And it attracts plenty of attention. It's the second year that an unmarked black 2015 Camaro has been used as a public relations and traffic law enforcement tool for the Stutsman County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Chad Kaiser says the Chevy dealership in Jamestown makes the lease payments while the county pays the insurance.
Wilhelms donated the lease to us for the car to do programs with the school kids. It goes around to all the schools. Also, it is used for patrol during our DOT overtime, our seatbelt overtime, DUI overtime, all of those kinds of things we use that car for.
The Camaro with sheriff license plates is fully equipped with lights in the grill and back window. Kaiser says the Camaro is popular with his deputies who drive it based on how they've done issuing citations during special enforcement campaigns. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Next time on The Pulse, Tony Martinez was about to have a colonoscopy, and he had a question for his doctor.
How do you feel about doing this without anesthesia?
The doctor was surprised.
She said, well, I think that would be very difficult for you. Why would you want to do that?
Opting out of medical treatments and choices.
I just want to see if it can be done.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A couple of federal agencies you probably haven't heard of keep track of what farmers grow, what Americans eat, and how the whole food system works. The Trump administration wants to move these agencies out of Washington. While it would be good news for the cities competing to win the jobs, some argue that it's bad news for farmers, taxpayers, and consumers who rely on credible food research. Frank Morris reports for Harvest Public Media.
The Economic Research Service collects and crunches numbers on everything from how much corn syrup Americans eat to how tariffs affect farmers. The National Institute of Food and Agriculture funds research closely tracking climate change, for instance. Last summer, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue announced that both agencies would be leaving Washington. He says he wants them closer to farmers and public universities doing agricultural research.
My first thought was Kansas City would be the perfect place.
Kansas Senator Jerry Moran supports the move. Greater Kansas City is in the hunt, along with North Carolina and Indiana.
Not every job in government needs to be in Washington, D.C., and in addition to the benefits that can come from places across the country by having those federal jobs there. If done correctly, this is an opportunity to save some money.
But many in the research community say it's not efficiency driving the move, but hostility towards science.
So I think that moving the agencies out of D.C. is going to significantly dilute their effectiveness as well as their relevance.
Ricardo Salvador with the Union of Concerned Scientists says the Economic Research Service will lose relevance if it's removed from policymakers and other federal researchers. Some say the agency's effectiveness has already taken a hit.
Efforts made by the secretary to move the agency, but really I think to undermine the agency, have just destroyed morale.
This former Economic Research Service employee asked that we not use his name because he could lose his current job. He says working at the agency was great until about a year and a half ago, when he says researchers began to fear tackling politically sensitive topics. Then Secretary Perdue pushed to take the agency out from under nonpartisan oversight and place it under his control. Finally, the surprise announcement to move it, along with the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, out of Washington, triggered a cascade of resignations.
I think it's had its intended effect. You know, people have left. Morale is low. The agency will take a long time to recover from the damage that's been inflicted.
The Trump administration wanted staff reductions years ago. All three Trump budgets have proposed deep cuts to the agencies. Ricardo Salvador argues that's because objective research often clashes with political ideology. Economic Research Service studies, for instance, concluded that tax cuts championed by the administration would most benefit the richest farmers, and that nutrition programs that Trump wanted to cut are good for the economy.
The secretary is clearly dealing with inconvenient facts by going to the source and eliminating them.
But people still working at the agencies are fighting back. Peter Winch works for the American Federation of Government Employees, a union that Economic Research Service employees just joined.
What they're trying to do is at least slow down, if not stop, USDA's plan to relocate them outside of the Washington, D.C. area.
For his part, Senator Moran argues that farm research agencies can be both relocated and well-supported. And he has helped to fight off efforts to cut ag research in the past. He says farmers, ranchers, and policymakers can't make sound decisions without reliable agriculture department data. But that's exactly the problem critics have with the proposal to move the two research agencies. They say the USDA hasn't produced a bit of data to support it. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
You can follow farm and rural issues online at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on Main Street, marketing North Dakota commodities.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by phone by Angela Runyon-Frericks. She is with the Agricultural Risk Consulting Group. She's a grain marketing advisor, and she's based in Turtle Mountain, North Dakota. Angie, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
What is the Agricultural Risk Consulting Group?
The Agricultural Risk Consulting Group is a consulting firm that is comprised of former grain marketers and risk managers specializing in managing the risks inherent in agriculture. We're completely aligned with our farmers' best interests, and we help them stay independent and manage the three decisions that they have to make, which is their futures, their carry, and their basis.
Is this a relatively new idea in North Dakota, or has this kind of thing been around for a long time?
Oh, I think it's been around for a while. I just don't know how deep it has gone. ARC Group is based out of Lincoln, Nebraska. My branch office here in Turlake has been around for 5 years. And I know that we've grown substantially. We've got some wonderful farmers in the area. And there's always a need for a good marketing plan. And that's just one thing that we help our farmers with.
Is the Agricultural Risk Consulting Group a fee-for-service kind of business?
Yes, we get paid a yearly contract, and we're not incentivized by how many trades that we put on for a client. That being said, we do trade. We are commodity brokers. We're licensed as such so that we can put on their hedges.
What services do you provide?
Well, we help them with full farm risk management. So we help them to set their futures price, decide when and if they should roll carry, and then when to sell basis to help them maximize the profitability. A lot of times that means helping them with some break-even numbers or helping them establish a strategic plan that is going to be executed with our assistance so that they can stay on track and make those decisions, even though in times like you're seeing right now with these crazy markets, it can be emotional, and that emotional decision-making and frustration and procrastination can just really harm a farm business.
We often think of North Dakota farmers as hardy individualists. Do most farmers kind of do their own risk analysis and just gut it out, or do they often use consultants?
You know, I think it's a nice mix. I know that we've been very well received on the consulting side. I always tell folks it takes you a year of going through it so that you can see exactly where the benefit is. Not only do we help them to set their hedges, but when it comes time to sell that basis, we're helping them on the decision-making piece of when to sell, where to sell, what's going to be the best process for them to take. If they're storing it in their bins, making sure that they capitalize on the carry. If they need some assistance with freight, making sure that we get some freight out there for them.
Well, let's jump into some of these terms right away because you've used them, and for me they're somewhat confusing. You've mentioned the word basis. What does that mean to a farmer marketing a crop?
Basis is the difference between the futures price and the cash price.
And the cash price is what you can get right now?
Exactly. So when most guys, when they're looking at the elevator price, they're looking at a bid sheet, they just look at the cash price. And if you're going to be a hedger and have a marketing plan, you want to disregard the cash price and watch basis. Because if you are setting your futures price ahead of time, you have a good idea of what your crops are going to be selling for. So then you just watch for the most applicable basis to execute that decision.
What's the significance of the difference between the basis price and the futures price? If there's a big difference, what does that mean to the farmer? If there's a little difference, what does that mean?
Well, if they've got their basis pretty wide, they're probably not real interested in the commodity. It's another way for an end user to either help originate bushels or to deter a farmer from delivering. A lot of times you will see when markets take a substantial move higher, your basis immediately widens. The end users are trying to make money as well, and so they're trying to act accordingly with their basis and their margin pieces to keep that level.
So the closer these things are together, the better it is for the farmer?
Absolutely.
What about the carry? What does that mean?
The carry in the market is the difference between your nearby price and your futures price. So it's still futures positions, but is this difference between 1 month to the next? In spring wheat, for example, if a guy is going to roll his new crop spring wheat from a September position to a March position, you know, at times he can get 30 cents of carry. And if you're going to be storing that grain, you might as well be paid for it.
So that is, the carry is the amount you're basically compensated for holding onto the grain, storing it on your farm?
Yes.
Do farmers usually have marketing plans? aside from I'm going to grow corn this year, I'm going to grow soybeans this year, I'm going to sell them when I'm done growing them?
You know, generally they don't. Farmers have a lot on their plate. They have a lot of responsibilities, and it is a lot of work getting it in the ground, keeping it sprayed, keeping it maintained. They have a lot on their plate, and they have very good intentions, and some of them do a great job. And other folks, just you get a little overwhelmed. I think everybody tries really hard, but that's where a marketing advisor can come into play for them and help them execute that plan. They may say it verbally to another person, this is what my plan is going to be, but actually writing down that plan and then modifying that plan when necessary and then having somebody help you execute it makes a lot of difference.
So is one of the jobs you might have advising a farmer what to plant?
No, they generally take care of that themselves.
Okay.
If they ask us questions on break evens, we can help them, you know, make those determinations. But no, they pretty much determine what they're going to plant.
So if a farmer is planting soybeans, your role might be to tell them, well, if you plant soybeans, this is what it's going to, you know, this is your break-even price. This is, so consider what it's going to cost you to grow them.
Well, we'd help them put all that math together if they needed it. Absolutely. Make sure that they know exactly where prices are right now as far as futures. Check and see how far it is at the time we're speaking to them. You know, what's the new crop price look like? And then they can take all of their math. They can take all of their break-evens and get a rough idea of what they would get for a cash price and then determine, is it feasible to raise that or should I be looking at another commodity?
Over the past couple of years and this year, we've been hearing that North Dakota's commodity crops have been kind of taking a beating. It's been a tough market. How would you describe the market right now? Is it volatile? Is it stable? Where is it?
I would definitely not call it stable, that's for sure. I would say that it is very volatile. And, you know, one thing about these rallies, whether you're having an increase in the price or a decrease in the price, all of this activity just means there are more opportunities out there. So if a guy has not started any marketing plan yet, now's a great time to start.
Okay.
You're capitalizing on all that emotion that's in the market. You know, it's a great time to keep going, keep selling.
Well, we're told that a lot of farmers are looking at the calendar with some concern because planting is getting late for a lot of people. Have you been hearing that?
Yes. Yes, I know a lot of our clients have been very concerned about making sure they're getting crops in because of the moisture. I think that's pretty much a general consensus through most of our I-states and I know through most of our state as well.
Now, individual farmers have their own input costs. Somebody might have really good land and maybe need less fertilizer or something like that. So what elements do you consider when you're talking to a farmer about what that break-even number might be?
Absolutely everything that it takes for them to raise that crop. Their fertilizer, chemical, their seed. On spring wheat, for example, I know one spot where a guy has a tendency to forget is if you apply another application of fungicide, that's another input cost. Your freight, your crop insurance, all of those pieces come together to make up the actual what it takes to raise that commodity.
Now, we've heard a lot about tariffs because a number of North Dakota commodities like wheat and soybeans and corn are exported, corn to Mexico and soybeans to China and lots of other places too. Has that affected these markets as you see them?
Oh, I'm sure it has. It just plays into more emotion into the market. Supply and demand, it's the same old thing. It's going to wreak havoc until everything is straightened out. But again, you know, I can't stress enough that if a guy hasn't started something, this volatility gives them a place to start.
So they might want to think about a different kind of crop?
Oh, they might start thinking about prices that are sitting out there. You just look at the futures prices on corn, for example. I know it's really volatile, and we're looking at a lot of acres that aren't planted yet, but you don't have any definitives. So just coming up with a plan and looking at those prices and saying, can I make money at those prices? If so, then that's a good decision.
Now, we're also hearing that the dollar is strong worldwide, and that, of course, makes our products a little more expensive, depending on how strong the dollar is, when we export them. Is this affecting the profits for farmers?
Well, anything that affects the exports definitely would affect the farmer, true.
So when you talk to farmers around the Turtle Mountain area, are they feeling good about this crop year or troubled?
You know, I've heard a little bit of both. I've heard a lot of them that are just really excited about the fact that this is great growing conditions for spring wheat and canola, as long as it gets in the ground. So there's kind of a variety of excitement, depending on which side of the state you're standing on. You know, the one side of the state's got more corn and soybeans in it than the other. So the eastern side of the state's got a little more stress right now and getting their corn in and then having such a, you know, a saturated ground. But I think they're all just generally, you know, they're pretty upbeat for what's going on.
Well, let's talk about different areas of the state. Of course, you're up in the north central area, I guess, roughly. How would you define the different areas in North Dakota in terms of the crops that are grown there and, you know, the potential profitability just because of where you're located?
Well, the northern part of the state right now, you know, that's a little bit drier than the southern part of the state. But it also has the majority of the canola. Canola and spring wheat run rampant in North Dakota. Those are two of our biggest pieces. And then corn and soybeans over on our eastern side of the state, not saying that the western side of the state doesn't plant them, but, you know, the majority of them are over on the eastern side of the state. I think they look good all the way around.
So it's not a disaster is what you're saying, and because there has been some talk about how difficult things have getting and that banks are getting reluctant to loan and loans are being called in and farmers are under a lot of stress. You're not hearing that, huh?
Well, no. They're under a lot of stress. But, you know, everybody's situation is different. And I have to say, just from our clients and from the people that we talk about, they're pretty positive. Yes, everybody's facing some structure changes this year on how, when, if, what's going to happen with tariffs, what's going to happen with the dollar, are we going to be exporting? But you still have a crop to plant. It's still their business, and they're still going to hold on to that pretty tight.
You know, when we drive around the state, those of us who aren't farmers and don't know a whole lot about this industry, we see a farm here, we see one next to it, and we think, oh, well, those are farmers. But they're individual small businesses in the sense that they're on some pretty expensive land in some cases and, you know, highly leveraged perhaps. But each farm is its own unique entity, right?
Correct. And you can't really lump all farmers together. It's not difficult. You know, there are some that work with maybe a worse area of the state as far as land goes, maybe some that have drought conditions constantly. They're all going to have a spot somewhere that they're going to struggle with.
Well, we're always reminded that, you know, during the summer growing season, it can hail on somebody's farm and wipe them out, and the next guy has a bumper crop. That can happen, too. So when you are looking around the Turtle Mountain area, do you see that there might be some farmers who won't be around next year?
You know, I would really hate to say that. I think that with some good decision making that they'll all be around next year.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else about the marketing of these commodities that we should know that I haven't asked about because I don't know?
You know, I think the only piece that I can't stress enough is have a marketing plan. Have somebody help you execute it. And if you don't have one, get a plan in place. Even though it's a real scary time right now, nobody knows what the export situation is going to be. We keep constantly hearing about tariffs. Market prices are moving, but you still need to make those decisions on pricing your grain. And that's not going to go away.
All right.
So make a plan. Stick with the plan.
Angela Runyon-Frericks is a grain marketing advisor with the Agricultural Risk Consulting Group. She's located in Turtle Mountain, North Dakota. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Sarah Vowell explains why the Marquis de Lafayette was such an important figure in the American Revolution.
He had kind of been
almost adopted as George Washington's son.
Sample a few wee drams when you tour the whiskey distilleries of Scotland and find adventure on the road to Machu Picchu.
If guys with bowl cuts wearing dresses come out of the jungle, run.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 4th. Fargo residents pulled out all the stops for the city's 75th anniversary of incorporation. A week-long celebration of daily events marked the occasion. Fargo started as a railroad town along the Red River, where the Northern Pacific Railroad crossed from Minnesota into Dakota Territory. The town was named after banker William G. Fargo and boomed as Dakota grew along the railroads. Today, Fargo is North Dakota's largest community. At the time of the celebration, in 1950, it had a mere 38,000 residents. The event was called a Diamond Jubilee, and it began on this date on a Sunday with a theme of Freedom of Religion Day, complete with morning church services and baccalaureate ceremonies at Concordia College in Moorhead and at the North Dakota Agriculture College in Fargo. One of the larger events began the next day, Fargo-rama. It ran for 6 nights at the Red River Valley Fairgrounds. It was a narrated pageant of Fargo and North Dakota history featuring hundreds of cast members. 17 episodes with various scenes told the story of fur trading, native tribes, steamboats, railroads, the city's founding and growth, and even the Great Fire of 1893. Cast members from Fargo, Moorhead, and nearby towns portrayed the 48 states, explorers, settlers, railroad surveyors, and other figures. There was a parade of progress with high school achievers in categories like science, music, swimming, and home economics. Marvel Rudolph was Miss Fargo Diamond Jubilee. Mary Kohler was Miss Red River Valley. Senator Milton Young and Mayor Murray Baldwin crowned both women on the first night of Fargo-rama. Each woman had princesses in their court of honor. Fargo-rama concluded its show with the entire cast of hundreds in a grand finale spectacle of music with tributes to the past and a vision to the future. 2025 will be Fargo's sesquicentennial. Perhaps Fargo-rama will return with new episodes of City History. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Educators sometimes seclude and restrain children in public schools.
They won't grow up to be adults that have difficulties with physical aggression and dangerous behavior.
But what if teachers fail to report what they're doing or even become violent themselves?
They shoved me to the ground, they grabbed my wrist, and they dragged me up the hill by my wrist.
Also, will Congress crack down on big tech on the next morning edition from NPR News?
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, one of the honorees in NPR's Student Podcast Challenge was Cassandra Sanders of Jefferson Elementary in Fargo. And on our show tomorrow, we'll share a sample of her work. Student podcasting is one of the many things Prairie Public's Education Division works on, and we'll discuss resources available for teachers. And Bill Thomas talked to people at the recent Antiques Roadshow event at West Fargo's Bonanzaville. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.